You know, this is, excuse me, a damn fine cup of coffee.
I don't need you to tell me how good my coffee is, okay?
Welcome, listeners, to another episode of A Damn Fine Cup of Culture. Today is a very special day because we're starting out into our summer series, the third summer series in a row, and our summer will be dedicated to remakes. Those movies that have a bit of a questionable reputation in terms of quality sometimes. Should a film be remade if it's a classic? Is a remake maybe beneficial to people who see a movie for the very first time? Can a remake ever be better than the original? We'll delve into many of these questions and more in the next four episodes. And I'm joined with Matt. Good morning, Matt.
Hello.
And Julie. Hey, Julie.
Hello.
To talk about a very special set of remakes, but we'll get into that a little bit later because I wanted to ask you, because we have a first chance to talk about remakes, what is your take on a remake in general? Julie, how do you feel about remakes? Anything that sticks out, what would you say?
Well, we tend to forget that some of the remakes are remakes of remakes of remakes. The very famous Maltese Falcon with Humphrey Bogart is a remake. The original one featured Thelma Thord, and I think it's worth 31. Well, I may be mistaken, but somewhere in that region. So that is considered, I think, a great classic, but it's also a remake. So I think sometimes we look at remakes with very modern eyes, and we think of franchises and of sort of semi-crappy rip-offs. But that is not necessarily the case, and we will get into this a lot more this summer. There are a great many remakes that are more famous than the original, or the original before that, or the original before that. So I suppose it's been around since the inception of movies.
How about you, Matt? How do you feel about remakes? Are you in the camp of discarding them right away because the original is always better, or what's your take?
I think I come at this actually from the perspective of theater more than of cinema. No one would say there can just be one Hamlet, or once you get Hamlet right, you can never make it again. I think a good story can always be told in different ways, and telling a story is always also interpreting a story. Good stories can be told in multiple ways, bad stories too, by the way. So in that respect, I have no fundamental problem with remakes philosophically. I do at the same time think that most of them are shit, basically. I think most of them are creatively bankrupt, and most of them, I think, come out of producers thinking, hey, we can make money because there's brand recognition. And that I have a problem with. But remaking stories, I do not have a problem with at all. There's nothing new under the sun, and I'm definitely with Roger Ebert in that he said it's not what a movie is about, it's how it is about it. And just taking the same overall plot says very little about what a film can be and will be. I mean, look at something like Invasion of the Body Snatchers. The different versions there, I think, are worthwhile because they say different things about the society and the culture in which they were made. Or something like La Chute, the Chris Marker film, and then 12 Monkeys. You can have a discussion there about whether it's a remake or a whatever it is. But I think, you know, drawing clear definitional lines, I wouldn't want to do that because I don't think that's where the interesting conversation is. I have to say, though, I dislike the notion of remakes as a second chance to get a story right. I think that can happen, absolutely. But with a good story, I don't think there's a best way to tell it. Times change, contexts change, interpretations change. And perhaps just finally, I like a remake most when it enters into a dialogue of sorts with the original. When it, for instance, changes the perspective, when it focuses on subtext, and when the two films then enrich one another. It happens very, very rarely, I think, but I think it's the potential that remakes have. What about you, Sam?
Well, absolutely. I would say my approach is rather to the screenplay than the finished film. I think, you know, if there's material on the page and it could be interpreted so differently by different filmmakers, even same filmmakers, and at different times, I think if somehow the production, the remake production is able to take it into the present day of when the film is made. And as you say, say something that is different about it, not just trying to cash in on the qualities of the original and say, okay, let's see how this is going to work with a present day audience. If there is something new to be said, I'm also thinking of examples like Cape Fear. where Scorsese really took part of the original, even the soundtrack of the original, and made it into something that is distinctly his, that I thought, for instance, is a successful remake, even though some would argue that the original is still better. Of course, I also think of movies that were opened up, as I said at the beginning, for the first time to audiences. I'm thinking of all these original Japanese or French movies that were remade by often American productions. Sometimes it's a chance even for the original to be seen because the film is remade or was remade. So I think that's also something that can happen, that can kind of reactivate parts of movie history, maybe open up even a new corner of the world to audiences and realize, okay, great films are not just made by these few countries, but there are good originals that might also be a good combination in comparison. I also have difficulty with the fact that there are so many remakes at times that you feel, you know, people are just repeating the same material, the same screenplays. There must be more. There must be original, fresh material. But as we will see this summer, it depends very much on the filmmakers in charge and the teams that are approaching this and from what angle.
Definitely, very much so.
So if we talk about our first couple of movies that we want to talk about, this is a bit of a special situation that we start out with. And I'm quite excited that we chose this as our first setup. The two films that we're talking about were made by the same filmmaker and, of course, one of the great filmmakers, Alfred Hitchcock. And maybe we can talk a little bit about the fact that Hitchcock is remade here, that also other filmmakers have often attempted to be like Hitchcock. What's your general take on Hitchcock movies being remade or made again? Is that a risk or is it also a chance for a new approach?
I would say that I perhaps have a fundamental problem at understanding why people would remake Hitchcock to some extent. Because the thing is, what makes a Hitchcock movie for me, especially what makes his best films, is not so much the story, it's the mise-en-scene, it's how he makes these films. And that is so ultra-specific to Hitchcock. I think the stories, I mean, quite a lot of them are quite pulpy, some of them are kind of witty and funny, some of them are kind of a bit trashy. And it's his filmmaking that elevates them. So remakes, by and large, they just take a story, they take the characters, and they do that differently, which I think, you know, there's potential in that. I think there's also potential in that with the stories that Hitchcock made. But what are you remaking then? You're remaking the plot, which is not what a Hitchcock film is about, first and foremost. A Hitchcock film is first and foremost about the thrills. It's about guys hanging from the nose of a president at Mount Rushmore. It's about, you know, the stabbing under the shower. It's about style. It's about using cinema as visual language. So what exactly would a remake do? And what remains of Hitchcock if basically what you're doing is just telling the story in a different way?
Are you similarly critical, Julie, of Hitchcock remakes, an attempt thereof?
Okay, let me put it this way. If you look at modern thrillers, I think they are all beholden to Hitchcock. I wouldn't say that every modern thriller we have is a remake. But if you look at the distinctive Hitchcock style has been copied and redone and revisited and reinvented for television, for film, I think in a sense, Hitchcock's style has been copied in almost every modern thriller that we have. In as much as I think Hitchcock could be remade, yes, Hitchcock could be remade. And it could be done cleverly and it could be done with sensitivity. It's just not really been done properly before. I mean, think of Marnie, right? This is a problematic film. But you could, as you said earlier, Sam, if you put a different perspective on it, it might work. I don't know why they have not been remade, but they are not sacrosanct in themselves. They are flawed often, or with our current eyes, extremely problematic and rapey. So yeah, I think in a stylistic sense, we do copy a lot of Hitchcock. And in the plot sense, I don't quite understand why it's not been done more often.
It's a very good question. It might be that some of the attempts that have been made were less than successful. Because I think the reactions to it, I think the amount of fans and critics that will descend on you for remaking or attempting to remake Hitchcock is probably so impressive that you shy away from it. But definitely, I think we rather have a collection of Hitchcock references in all current thrillers and comedies and spoofs. I'm thinking of, you know, Mel Brooks' High Anxiety, that so perfectly assembled all the Hitchcock elements. And maybe that's the only thing that you can do to remind people of how good Hitchcock's version actually was. And that's the problem with it. But definitely also that the stylistic elements have crept into all kinds of genres, and that probably for any casual movie watcher, the term Hitchcockian or Hitchcock reference is the one that opens up most quickly. I think most people would recognize or realize, aha, Hitchcock, even if they don't have an idea about the original, they would recognize something is suspenseful, and then the link is immediately made to Hitchcock as the master of suspense. So it's become such a huge term, I think, that it's even hard to say what is a proper remake of something, unless it's something like Gus Van Sant's Psycho that tries to copy everything shot by shot, or whether it's just the puzzle pieces that have been, you know, thrown onto the cinematic floor and then are picked up by all kinds of filmmakers, mm-hmm. consciously or not, or perceived by audiences as Hitchcockian. But it's a complex field.
Definitely. I mean, I would say that if you look at something like a Brian De Palma thriller, chances are there's more Hitchcock in that, even though it's a different plot, it's not a remake as such, than there is in a, I think there was a Hollywood remake of Dial M for Murder, which takes the plot, but the heart, the soul, the guts of Hitchcock are not there.
Right. And De Palma, of course, you know, could be the material for an entire series of podcasts too, just this De Palma and Hitchcock. But something like Obsession, that is so close to Vertigo without being Vertigo, you could say it's almost a straightforward remake, but it still does something very differently. And I think stylistically, the atmosphere, everything is so different at the same time. But today we want to stay with Hitchcock, the man himself, because in his illustrious career, he actually did think of remaking films. There were a couple of projects that he was thinking of remaking, improving. And the one that he actually did remake is The Man Who Knew Too Much. And I think it's fairly interesting to compare these two and to talk about both. The first version, 1934, is of course happening at the height or at the pinnacle of his British career. 5 years later, he sets for the US and for Hollywood. The second one is in the middle of his period where he's already an established filmmaker in 1956 in Hollywood. Made with Universal Studios, nicely settled in Hollywood and in his career. And he himself, I think I'm going to take this quote first, said, you know, the first film is the work of an amateur. The second one is the one of a professional. And I think we can maybe come back to this impression and whether we agree or disagree with it in those two versions. But let's start off with the 1934 version that he made, which was one of his first big successes. And established him really as also well-loved by audiences and critics alike. How did you feel watching it, maybe for the first time or for a repeated time this time around? What are the qualities of The Man Who Knew Too Much? What sticks out?
Peter Lorre, that's a simple answer. He's grand in this. He's having such a blast. I know it's a bit ham for modern eyes, but I love every minute of it. I think it's delicious. I think it aged better than the second one. There's a quality of modernity to it, a freshness to it. I think that stands up rather well. There's this sort of fashionable couple with a kind of push me, pull you, laughing comedy routine, and a little kid who's not too precocious. Well, not too precocious, right? And the story takes us from there. Again, Peter Lorre is such a powerhouse. I have in my notes, and this is literally what I wrote down with a timestamp, is that he acts with his ears. You can see him from the back of his head and you can see his ears move in the tension when there's a gunfight about to ensue. I think it's a lovely picture. I think it's perfectly understandable even now why it was such a smash. And I think it holds up pretty well for a film of that era.
Matt, how about you? Did you have similarly enthusiastic reactions to it?
I would say so. I mean, perhaps to begin with, I have to say I'm probably unlike the two of you. I've seen some of the earlier Hitchcocks, the English films, but I don't know them that well. Basically, the Hitchcocks I grew up with, the Hitchcocks I've seen most often are obviously around the era of Psycho, of Vertigo, Rear Window, and North by Northwest. So whenever I see one of the early films, I find it fascinating to see, you know, how in so many ways you can already see what Hitchcock will do later. It's usually a bit rougher around the edges because he just hasn't had the practice yet. But at the same time, there's a freshness that I find quite delightful. And I think that freshness is here totally. And I also think that, you know, you see some of the stuff that you'll get later, the kind of the globe trotting element that some of his films had. Here it's perhaps not Marrakesh, it's, you know, the Alps, but still you get the sense that he wants to please the audience with, you know, look here, touristy locations, fun characters. And they are fun characters. I think I really like what Julie mentioned, the kind of snappy, witty repartee between the couple, which reminded me more of films like, let's say, The Thin Man, to some extent, than of the later Hitchcock films. The staging is very often very inventive and fun, like the ski jump or the dance party, and then the woolen thread that the husband kind of puts around the dancers because of, you know, there's a little bit of jealousy going on. Or I'm thinking of the scene in the church, which is partly repeated in the remake, but I think here it feels very fresh, you know, where they're basically the husband, the main male protagonist, and the uncle character, where they talk to each other by singing the hymn, but using words to communicate. And then the chair fight, which is so totally ludicrous, but so much fun. They're in a kind of church. They're, you know, mostly kind of not even young, energetic action star people, but they're throwing chairs at each other for several minutes. And obviously also the concert and the bungled murder, although I think that's a scene that we'll come back to later. I think what I found odd was perhaps the ending. There's a long, drawn-out gunfight, and there the pacing of the film and the tone of the film changes quite a bit. To my mind, it almost felt more like proto-Michael Mann than it did like Hitchcock in a way. But even that was interesting. It's interesting to see where kind of the seeds of later Hitchcock style are totally there, but it's also interesting to see where he tries things differently and then perhaps later rejects or discards them. But finally, perhaps, Julie, I would totally agree with you. Peter Lorre is so much fun and he's so charismatic. It's so easy to kind of reduce him to a caricature of himself, but he does so much more than that. He can be really funny. He can be really threatening. He can even be poignant. And that's great. So I would say, you know, this film, the 34 version, it shows a lot of what Hitchcock is later famous for. It's perhaps less refined, but that roughness around the edges isn't something to enjoy in and of itself.
And it's that roughness that I really love about early Hitchcock. I think you said the word delightful. And I think what I notice whenever I watch the 30s Hitchcock, especially the successful ones, I want to cheer for certain moments. I remember the ending of The Lady Vanishes or the ski jump at the beginning. There's such a thrill. And just seeing a filmmaker trying to recreate such a difficult scene with the means that he has at the time, which must have been much more thrilling at a time, seeing it with eyes of 1930s audiences. I feel this enthusiasm that people had for Hitchcock's films and that freshness that they must have felt at the time with these films coming out. Us looking back is a very different experience than what I imagine people must have felt like seeing this for the very first time. So yeah, it's a delightful experience. I also think there's much more comedy in it than in later Hitchcocks. And I think in comparison, that is will be very noticeable, despite the stern subject matter and the, you know, potential tragedy that happens here. It's all set through with these fun moments. And you mentioned that the threat, you're in the dancing, the dynamic between the couple, even Peter Lorre giving us more comedy in a way, dark comedy than he does, give us thrills maybe or threat, even though, of course, he can do both. The cabinet of these characters, I think this Nurse Agnes really stuck out for me, one of the people that Peter Lorre works together, of course, for this plot. And I think it's that mix of thrills and comedy that then lead up to such successful suspense moments with Hitchcock, especially here. The Albert Hall finale, I think, works so well because then suddenly everything is working towards the suspense, the final moment. But you have been on a kind of this roller coaster ride of early Hitchcock and what he does so well. Even, I would argue, Matt, with these rough edges, I think there is even more, you know, ups and downs in that film. And I think that makes for such a delightful experience on the whole that the suspense in the end works so well, too.
Absolutely. You know how people often talk about Charade as the best Hitchcock film that Hitchcock never made? And you can see that when you look then at something like North by Northwest. But I think the tone that you get in that reminds me more of some of the earlier Hitchcock films, because the middle kind of period, the ones that I talked about, the Vertigos, the Rear Window, obviously there's humor, but I think this kind of repartee-based humor, you have more in the early films, I sometimes, and it definitely in this one, you totally have that. And that's great. You know, it's like a glass of champagne of a film somehow. It kind of tickles your nose.
I wanted to point out, and that struck me with the reviewing of this film, with this podcast in mind, the deaths are so sudden. I sort of never grokked that before, but the first death is almost unnoticeable, right? The man just sort of, I think he even apologizes before he sinks to the floor and he has been shot. And then the lady in the church as well, she gets up in a huff and bang, over. That's it, right? So I don't think we, or at least I, would typically associate that with Hitchcock, right? It's always the build-up, always the build-up. And here, the end comes so suddenly for these characters. It's sort of, I wrote it down because I was like, oh yeah, this is something that I'd never sort of really seen in my previous watches, and there have been a few of this movie.
Right. It might also be because later on Hitchcock became associated so much with these murder scenes that they became so extensive. I'm thinking of, you know, Torn Curtain trying to kill Wolfgang Hiling there, which, you know, is supposed to take a long time. And of course, that's the whole point. But here, I think it's much more snappy, fast. Things happen. I'm thinking also of the finale that you mentioned with the shootout. Things happen, and they often happen only visually. And I think you can see definitely the closeness, the proximity to his silent films here. There is sound, there is dialogue, but of course, the visual level is still much more important, I would say. There's less talky scenes, and if there are, they often are really about not what's happening visually. So I think maybe also even these deaths, just a face, someone collapsing, even Peter Lorre at the end, there's a lot of silence, but very, very impressive imagery. One image that is always with me is the daughter, Nova Pilbeam, being taken away on the sledge. And you see her face, you know, scared beside her kidnapper. And it's this, you know, it could be a painting, could be an expressionist painting. And it's almost complete silence. I think there's a couple of bells off the sledge, I'm not quite sure. But otherwise, this is such impressive visual language that maybe doesn't need more detail, more sound to it.
No, it really reminds us that Hitchcock made silent films, right? And he's really, really good at it.
Right, and there's so many visual details that are purely for viewers that just pick up on these things. I'm thinking of the bullet hole through the window and then all the fingers pointing to it. I mean, it's just a piece of art. It's just a still image that you could, you know, put up, frame it, and that's it. It's artificial, of course. You know, why would people do that? It just makes sense because he wants to create such powerful images somehow and has fun doing it. And I think The Man Who Knew Too Much, this version, is quite full of these small moments as well.
And the little thread making a spider's web in which our characters will become embroiled, you know. It's really fantastic stuff. Mm-hmm.
But I think it really straddles the kind of the more silent visual style and what comes with talkies really well, because not all films around that period do it so well. But I think for instance, the acting and the writing and the repartee and the wit that's there, the humor, it's very much a verbal humor. It's very different from the kind of films where you didn't have dialogues as such, but just the occasional text telling you this is what they're saying now, which is not really dialogue as such. Here you really have the back and forth. I think you've got the kind of tone that prefigures some of the romantic comedies, for instance, of the then 40s.
So it's Hitchcock at mixing these elements together, not for the very first time, but I think one of the first times that he was able to do this and where this came together so well. Maybe going back to his own quote, you know, the work of an amateur. Of course, we tend to think of amateur of someone who's not very good at it because he isn't professional. But I'm always thinking, well, amateur also means you love something. You know, you're someone who comes at it as a person who loves doing what he does. And I think that's what comes through, right? It is the work of an amateur in that sense, because he is working professionally, obviously, at that time, but it also has these elements of, you know, just trying stuff out because you can do it for the first time. Mm-hmm. Did you get that feeling too?
I think it's such a pompous quote and so typical of him, the work of an amateur. My goodness. Now, I think it's an accomplished work of a really big film fan. In that sense, you could compare it to Tarantino. He loves movies. He loves making movies. He loves having fun with movies. He loves having Peter Lorre hamming it up. if that's to be called an amateur, I could name several really big names that would also qualify.
I mean, I would totally agree with that. I think I don't want to do the comparison too much yet, but I would say if I'm going to geek out over one of those films, as I said, with glee, with delight, it's going to be the earlier film. I can absolutely see how some of the later film is more professional in certain ways, which requires more conversation amongst us afterwards to clarify what we might mean by that. But the first one, it's not amateurish. It has that amateur quality in that it's the quality of someone who is trying things out more. But exactly that trying out is just fun. Mm-hmm. And I mean, if I'm not mistaken, even though Hitchcock was already thinking about a remake in 1941, in the end, he did it to fulfill a contractual obligation to Paramount, right?
I know about his plans to remake it. I'm not too sure about the conditions under which it was eventually remade, because it is now under the Universal Films. But I'm not too sure about that, so I'm not going to go out on a limb here too much. But there was certainly early plans to remake it, having gone to the US only in 38, 39, starting off with Rebecca. Obviously, this is first big film, the Selznick contract that then put him under a lot of stress as well. And he thought of The Man Who Knew Too Much. It's interesting that that was the project he had on his mind. Maybe as a quick question, is there a need to remake it from the perspective of the version that we have? And why do you think it was The Man Who Knew Too Much he wanted to remake? Does that make sense to you in terms of the film that it is?
Yeah, it does. I think it does. It makes business sense, for starters. I wonder sometimes, it must have seemed not just fresh, but rather fashionable in the time that it was released. I'm not sure about this, obviously, because I wasn't born yet. But if something is such a smash hit, I can understand if you move to Hollywood that you would think of doing it, quote unquote, the American way, in an American style with American stars. Because, you know, the British films are relatively small ones. And if you can get a bigger budget, bigger names, I can imagine that it would make business sense to say, okay, let's redo this one for a bigger market.
I think so. You know, from my point of view, there's also moments where Hitchcock probably thought this set piece could be done better. I'm thinking of the Albert Hall scene. That is a delightful finale, of course, a very famous one, but maybe thinking of going back, doing that grander, bigger, longer, more extensive working on that. So maybe the things that he thought was amateurish because he had to find maybe cheaper solutions or easier solutions, and then having more possibilities, maybe also seeing what Hollywood offers in terms of the sound stages and technicians and possibilities. Maybe that was an incentive. I'm not quite sure why it is The Man Who Knew Too Much. I guess because it was a successful film, one of his first big successes, or his biggest. Maybe that, but I'm not too sure.
I think it's to some extent, structurally, it offers itself very well for a star vehicle, as Julie already alluded to. You know, you've got a husband-wife team, so you can get a big male star, a big female star, and that already brings in, you know, the punters. You would also have had the potential to, you know, star someone really exciting as the villain, which I think was missed. There's definitely no Peter Lorre in the remake, and I think the film suffers for it. You have the kind of globe trotting thing where you can start off in a, you know, an exciting location, perhaps make it even more exotic. And you've got color, of course, which you don't need with the snow covered mountain so much. So I can see why this one would lend itself to remaking. I don't know the other films of the earlier era too well, so I don't know which others have exactly those elements. But I can see that those would also, you know, the kind of big dollar sign lights in the producer's eyes will also light up.
Yeah, and Hitchcock finally was able to make it in 1956. And I think he definitely delivered on making it a star vehicle for his main characters, for the couple who loses their child to a kidnapper's plot and gets involved in that political intrigue once again. James Stewart and Doris Day are starring in this version. It's one of the films that I probably saw most often early on. It was very often on television, together with a couple of other 50s Hitchcock, like Vertigo, like Rear Window. And I always remembered liking it. It had James Stewart, it had the Herman score, it had Hitchcock moments that I remember. Obviously, the death of Louis Bernard at the beginning, the Marrakesh locations, or the exoticism that you were alluding to before, certainly is or was delivered to my mind. I'm quite, very curious to see how you felt about seeing it again. I'm pretty sure you had seen it repeatedly before. What was the experience like, especially also in contrast now to the 34 version?
What is it with Hitchcock that he can make Jimmy Stewart seem so charmless? I don't know how he does it. One of the most charismatic stars of the era that we always sort of associate with kindliness, right? And he's just so charmless in this one. Doris Day is a good sport, but the entire dynamic between the two, it doesn't work, does it? I mean, at points it's borderline abusive. And if that chemistry, that dynamic doesn't work, who are we really rooting for except Doris Day belting out "Que sera, sera" for all she is worth? I love that scene, by the way. It's fabulous. But it's sort of interesting to me that one of the things that stand out to me in the, shall we call it the original, is the dynamic between the couple, and that sort of gets lost in the second version. That was the first thing that sort of struck me when I rewatched it with this podcast in mind. I'd seen it often. I've probably not paid too much attention to it in the sense that you watch it and you know it so well, right? And you tend to sort of zone out a little bit. And I try to really focus myself on this as the remake of the first one. And I was like, it's really interesting how charmless this film is at points. I don't know if you agree with me or whether I'm completely wrong about this.
I am very much with Julie on this one. I have to say also, I watched it as a kid, probably repeatedly. I think probably very similarly to you, Sam. It's definitely one of the ones I remember seeing relatively early on. And I'm sure I enjoyed it. I definitely still don't think it's a bad film as such, but I think some of the stuff that stood out most for me with the original, the 34 version, is lost here. I think it is, in some ways, perhaps the more smoothly crafted film. It's the bigger film. You can see that Hitchcock has honed his skills, and you can see that Stewart and Day are stars in a way that, at least to a modern audience, wouldn't register with the 34 film. I don't know whether the leads in that one were stars of the same magnitude. But the McKennas are such bores. I mean, yes, Jimmy Stewart lacks any kind of charm or charisma, but I have to say, I really hated her too, because they come across as a parochial 50s US couple. He's kind of big-eyed and trustful, but she seems, you know, she seems like a proto-Karen somehow. You know, she distrusts all these foreigners with their foreign ways. That's how it comes across. Plus, the kid is more boring and more annoying, and you just want him to stay kidnapped, if not more than that. There's little of the sparkling wit and repartee of the original in the couple, and I think that, in comparison, makes the film suffer so much. It does have fun scenes, but the fun scenes, by and large, are not the scenes where the couple is there as a couple. So I can see how Hitchcock would have liked his chance of, you know, being better at his craft and putting that into practice. But when it comes to the characters, I think this is clearly second rate compared to the original.
I would say Slow Boat from Marrakesh.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
This is what I would call this. It's not, I think, you know, you mentioned that the characters and the way they're shown, I think it's also the filmmaking. I did not remember how slow this movie is and how static this film is. And if you think of Hitchcock, especially the original, but also films that he made around this, even something like To Catch a Thief, and obviously then there's the supposedly very static Rear Window, where you think, my God, what is he doing? Why is he keeping these long shots? And why is he just doing boring setups, especially for the Marrakesh location? I mean, they went there. It's not all a studio, even though they inserted a lot of studio shots then after the fact. So there is potential to do something much more interesting, but the interesting stuff is very far and few between. Even the interesting stuff, I'm thinking of the death of Louis Bernard, which is often shown in bits and pieces and best-offs, is so slow. You see this coming for so long, and you think, even though you might not know or remember that it is Louis Bernard at the end, and I think the shot with the hands is still great, but the whole setup on the marketplace is just, I was waiting for it, and then, you know, it just continues in a similar fashion.
It feels a bit like, you know, the Marrakesh Tourist Board paid him to just have nice big shots of, don't you want to go on holiday here? Even though there's foreigners that might kill you or whatever.
Drink tea at you.
But just foreign spies. They're just going to kill foreign spies, you know? So you're safe. as a James Stewart person or a Doris Day kind of family, you're safe.
Yeah. It seems almost like Hitchcock is bored with it. I know he'd planned very long to make this or remake this, but he just feels bored to me. There is none of the interest that he shows in his little movie adventure that he apparently had in the first one. I can't look into his head, but that is what it feels like to me. And here it's just by rote. It's like, now we have a grand landscape. Now we have a grand scene. Hold this shot. Pan out. Done. I don't know.
I mean, you do have the taxidermy scene, which stands out to me as just weird and goofy. And it's that goofiness that makes it so much more fun than much of the rest of it. I mean, compare that to the church scene, which repeats some of the stuff. Like, for instance, here you've got the couple rather than husband and uncle singing information to each other. But it just doesn't work as well. It just, the scene lacks energy. The taxidermy scene, that could be out of a different film. That could be any film. And that one feels like, you know, Hitchcock suddenly felt, let's have fun now, because the rest of it was kind of boring.
I had the exact same impression about this scene. I thought this could be out of Alfred Hitchcock Presents, just the beginning or the ending bit where he's himself maybe the owner of the shop. It is fun, but it's also out of place, because contrary to the original, I feel the comedy here does not work, because it is the kind of melodramatic element that's forefront with obviously the famous breakdown of Doris Day when she finds out that her son has been kidnapped, which I think, you know, acting wise is still impressive from someone that you think is just merely a comedy actress who can sing. And here she really does some work. And it's, I think it still works as a scene, but I think the comedy does not work then. And I think this these awkward cultural references to, you know, odd Marrakesh and what they do and how they carry their children and what they eat and how they sit. I mean, it's so jarring. And I guess at the time that was supposed to be funny. James Stewart with long legs trying to sit down on these cushions in the restaurant. But it's also, it's so drawn out, so long until we finally get to something interesting, which I think, again, is the Albert Hall scene, you know, clearly a highlight of the film. And I think much expanded with the means that they had, with Bernard Herrmann conducting the orchestra, which I think is a nice touch. And I think to your point, Matt, about the villains in the film, I think it really comes down to that, because the original had an array of interesting faces and characters, including Peter Lorre. This one has no one really. I'm thinking of maybe Reggie Nalder as the killer, which is a great face to have in any movie. He gets to do a little bit of impressive work especially when he talks and when he's so threatening. And the scene, I think, at the Albert Hall also works because of him. But apart from that, yeah, you don't feel threatened. You kind of know that probably they will get their kid back in the end. So you're never really scared for the kid. Maybe, as you said, you would like to have kidnapped any day. So I think that it comes back to the villain problem, I think.
Yeah, and the poor kid. I mean, deliver us from precocious child actors. But he's just not given very much to do either, is he?
And again, it's this kind of 50s US thing, which I think has aged so terribly. Probably even more so for, I don't know, there's probably people in America who think, yeah, that's what we should get back to. But yeah, for us, it definitely doesn't work. And with the villains, I have to say that the villainous couple, you know, compare it to something like North by Northwest, where you've got James Mason, who's fantastic. And then you've got his henchman, Martin Landau, who's fantastic. And then you've got two side villains, kind of henchmen, who don't need to be fantastic because you've already got Martin Landau, you've got James Mason. Here it's like you only have those two henchmen, basically. So if you had a strong Peter Lorre-style lead, then the villainous couple could work. But without that, it's just not interesting. It's just not fun. One thing I find interesting is I think both films have a problem of not quite knowing what to do with the wife character in the plot. I think to some extent that is a bigger problem in the original, in the 34 version, because for the longest time the wife doesn't have anything to do. They solved that partly with Doris Day. But at the same time, in the 34 film, she kind of saves the day because she's a badass. You know, she's badass with a gun, whereas Doris Day's badass with her voice is also something, but I prefer the kind of gun wielding in the first film, also because it's very well set up in the story.
Yeah, that's something you point out there, Matt. I remember, but if I remember wrong, please tell me, that the lady character, when the first death occurs, when the man is shot on the dance floor, She doesn't scream. She doesn't do the womanly, quote unquote, womanly thing that you'd expect in a very old film. She is a modern woman. And I agree with you. She should get more to do because she's really interesting. I think she's really interesting. And the problem with Doris Day is that she acts best when she sings, right? Let the woman sing, please, because anytime she is made to be funny when she doesn't sing, doesn't work, right? Because Doris Day is Doris Day, and she is the epitome of traditional womanhood and not of modern womanhood. So it was a bit of a clash for me. I was like, what's left of the lady character, guys, right?
And they swap her for James Stewart if you compare it to the original. You know, she gets the phone call in the original about the kid being kidnapped. She's the one who listens to the secret that Louis Renard gives her. All these scenes are changed. And of course, in the 1950s version, it's also then this collaboration between Doris Day singing and James Stewart actually getting the boy out of the embassy. So here, the female role has really been reduced to reacting melodramatically, accompanying. Of course, the emotional side of, you know, linking the kid and the song and so on is nicely done. And obviously, Que Sera was a smash hit, something that hardly ever happened for Hitchcock in his films, having a smash song in his films. But yeah, it says a lot about how women are shown, wives are shown between 1930s Britain and 1950s Hollywood.
Absolutely. I mean, I have to say one thing I like, at least in theory, is the structural change with the two different adventures with Ambrose Chappell, where he goes off because he thinks Ambrose Chappell, it's this guy. And while he's off having that adventure, she realizes, no, it's a place. I think that's clever. It's not used to the best effect, but it makes the middle part, structurally, it makes the middle part kind of more interesting than the writing otherwise makes it. But that's a kind of a small benefit coming out of that whole bit.
A very small one. I think it takes so long. And then there's this group of friends that are waiting for them in their apartment. And it's so charming in 1950s as well. These, you know, cocktail party friends who just come over to chat. It almost takes away from that double structure that could work if it was more tightly edited as well. I think it just goes together with the length. The thing is 2 hours long and more. It should be at least half an hour shorter.
Yeah, and what's the gaggle doing there, Sam? Why did they bring in a gaggle of socialite women? It makes no sense.
Probably had some obligation to some actresses to, you know, to cast them, or they just needed to bring in some more characters. I'm not sure.
I can see it working in a different film, but I think it's basically tonally the film kind of veers too much from drama to more adventurous. And I don't think it ever makes those two things work together. I think Hitchcock has done that blend much, much better in so many films.
Well, what is telling, I think, is also that the things that do work are kind of straight from the original. I'm thinking also of the phone shot, you know, getting close to the head with the phone on their ear in both movies, pretty much doing the same thing with the Albert Hall, even though they have many more possibilities. I think it goes to show that the things that really stand out of the remake is also what stands out in the original, even if the original is kind of doing this more tightly, more amateurishly in Hitchcock's definition. But maybe the work of a professional here is not a benefit, because his definition of being professional ends up being also slightly routine-y, I guess. A professional who goes through certain filmmaking routines. He has assembled his team of people that he's now having in place. Edith Head does great costumes, obviously. There's the editing, the camera, people that are already established Hitchcock collaborators. But somehow, yeah, the inspiration was missing. The freshness definitely was missing. That, I think, is the biggest problem the movie has.
Yeah, it's such a pity. I'm so glad you mentioned Edith Head, because the people who are involved with this project are fabulous. It's such a missed opportunity, and it's such a pity that it sort of falls flat.
And still, I would say that, you know, as I said, as a kid, I liked it. I still think it's not an outright bad film. It's just, especially in comparison, I think if I just watched it on its own, I would have basically come away from it thinking, yeah, some nice scenes, but definitely not my favorite, and I would have moved on. It's by seeing the earlier version shortly before it and seeing what could be there, I think that is what highlights for me where the remake just goes wrong. I can totally see how, you know, if you mush the two together, if you take some of the stuff that works well in the second one, perhaps, you know, just Hitchcock's experience by that time, but you put it together with, I think, the script of the first one. Take that as the basis. Because I think what happened was, I can't remember who wrote the script for the second one. He told him the basic outline of the plot, told him, do not read the original script, take that basic outline and write that story again. And that means you lose the stuff that is great about the script of the first one, the repartee, the wit, the sparkle. So I could imagine even a remake of this that takes some of the qualities of the later one, puts them together with the qualities of the first one, and it would be great. It would be fun. I don't think it would be necessary, but it would definitely be less leaden than what we got.
Yeah, and you'd have to cast it differently. I think if that is what you're after, instead of the sort of more melodramatic tone that Sam referred to, you'd think Cary Grant, Grace Kelly, something like that. You wouldn't necessarily think the epitome of, you know, American virtue in Doris Day and Jimmy Stewart. I think you'd then have to cast it very differently as well, because they're signaling something with this casting, right? This is the standard American couple, the ideal American couple. It's all a little bit xenophobic and a little bit tasteless, but that's what they're signaling here. And if you wanted a mashup, I think you'd also need different casting. No disrespect to either actor, because I'm a great admirer of both. But in this case, then it just wouldn't wash, I don't think.
And with that, it's such an animal of its time, right? Which probably the 1930s version is as well. But the fact that the screenwriter did come up with that version based on what Hitchcock told him and came up with, you know, who is James Stewart as a character? What does he do in life? Who is his wife? Those decisions must have been made by the screenwriting. And Hitchcock just provided the dramatic outline of what happens leading up to the big finale. So anything that was filled in by 1950s Hollywood screenwriter, I think, does scream 1950s and what kind of expectation you would have in these characters. And I think that's the key problem. Maybe Hitchcock should have screened that film for him, John Michael Hayes, and really showed him the quality also just structurally, visually, of the original to give him a different idea and to maybe also hint to that freshness, that dynamic between the couple, which certainly is not there or is a very different one.
Absolutely. Though at the same time, let's be fair, I could imagine that an American 50s audience would have eaten this up. They would have loved the conservative nature of this coupling, possibly. I think it might have sold better to kind of middle America in the 50s, but it also means that the film has way less longevity than the biggest hits that Hitchcock made.
So if not even Hitchcock can remake his films properly, who can?
Mel Brooks.
Yes, I was going to ask you. So Hitchcock remake, Hitchcock pastiche, we mentioned them at the very beginning. So many different influences that Hitchcock has had on modern thrillers and film in general. What are some successful examples that you would mention that you would say, okay, someone really took the Hitchcock out of this and put it into something very successful, whatever kind of film it is? Mel Brooks for you?
I have to say I'm actually not that much into Mel Brooks, but I'm also kind of, comedy is hit and miss for me. The film I would mention is not even a film I like that much, but I think it's a film that justifies the remakiness. And it's not even a straightforward remake. It's the 2013 film Stoker by Park Chan-wook, the Korean filmmaker starring Mia Wasikowska, Matthew Good and Nicole Kidman. And it's, I think, at the very least, a reimagining of Shadow of a Doubt. You've got the same kind of setup. You've got the single mother, the kind of precocious daughter, and you've got the murderous evil uncle. The difference in Stoker is that the daughter herself has quite a lot of qualities that the uncle has. And that means that you watch it, you remember Shadow of a Doubt and the dynamics there, and the change in dynamics, I think, illuminates both films. As I said, I don't necessarily like the film. I think Stoker, it's quite an unpleasant film. It's definitely, it feels reptilian. It kind of slithers in a way that's effective and horrible. But looked at as a remake of sorts, I think it's interesting because it does things that Hitchcock didn't or couldn't do at the time. And in doing so, it really enters into a dialogue. So that for me is the closest, where it takes the basic plot and gives it a twist. And it still feels Hitchcockian, which is, I think, as I said, I think if you just do the plot, that's not quite enough. So for me, that would be an interesting way of remaking Hitchcock.
Right. Julie, do you have an example like this as well?
No, I don't. I was just thinking, because you started with remakes by Scorsese, like The Departed, and he's fairly good at remakes. And I just entered my mind, why doesn't Scorsese do one? I want a Scorsese Hitchcock remake. Really, I do, for Christmas. Mr. Scorsese, my birthday is in December. Make it happen.
Which film would it be?
There are several that would benefit. I think Rope. Wouldn't that be grand? A Rope by Marty Scorsese?
Delicious, I think.
I can think of several actors who would be beautiful in it.
Right. I'm thinking myself also, I mean, you can be critical of De Palma and Argento and what they have done to Hitchcock. But I think if you create your own set of movies and you say, okay, I love Hitchcock, but I'm going to put this into my own style. And I think De Palma was often criticized for doing these one by one Hitchcock copies. But at the same time, it's a very different, very sultry 70s, 80s atmosphere. And even though a lot of his films are questionable, but sometimes I just love the fanboy in him that just says, okay, I love this so much. I'm going to make this into a sometimes horrible 1980s movie. But just the filmmaking, the attention to detail, his knowledge of Hitchcock. And I think Argento's, early thrillers, this animal trilogy has a similar quality to it. So I love sometimes even the film as a whole can be, repulsive or questionable. But just the fact that someone went to such lengths to recreate what they loved about Hitchcock and to somehow put a modern or different spin on it, I think I just admire. If we talk just of the Hitchcock remake-y aspect of it. So I would definitely recommend, watching Obsession or Body Double or Dress to Kill and the Argento thrillers, just to see the love for Hitchcock at play by someone who has such skills.
Wasn't Blowout also one of his? The one with John Travolta, that's very effective and in its own way, very Hitchcockian.
Absolutely. And just focusing on the sound aspect
right.
of it. Kind of a blow-up reference too. But it's a great De Palma, I think one of his best.
It is a wonderful film, yeah.
He does, though, also have the kind of heavy-duty sexism that Hitchcock had. And I have to say, in some respects, I find that more difficult to take in a 70s, 80s movie than in a 40s, 50s black-and-white movie, where there's already the distancing effect. And De Palma, I think Blowout has fantastic set pieces. It's got great ideas. But what it does with the female character is...
Yeah, and so much to say about, Dress to Kill or Body Double for that. And I think he gets a lot of flack for it, justifiably. But we would have to dedicate, one episode maybe to De Palma and Hitchcock.
Right. About how De Palma is problematic. I'll expect to be invited on that one.
You will get the invite for sure.
One thing I just remembered is, I don't know whether either of you remembers Mission Impossible 2, the John Woo film. Following up Brian De Palma while we're at it. And obviously Mission Impossible 2 is very much heavily inspired by Notorious. But then it also brings in, ultra slow motion and doves flying through smoke, which Hitchcock never did.
Unfortunately, we can never have Hitchcock, trying to imitate some modern day filmmakers like John Woo, for instance. It would be interesting if you gave Hitchcock the task to include doves flying through smoke. What would he do? The birds.
Or we could then have Michael Bay doing Rope, instead of no cut, no visible cut, one cut a second.
No, it's just, I think of Rope because Rope is an interesting film on paper. And for me personally, doesn't quite come off as a film, as pure entertainment. That is why it always springs to my mind. There are several that on paper I love. And then I watch them, I'm like, yes, come on, hurry up. So, yeah.
Definitely. And I think we're still on the other end of that spectrum. We're still awaiting news on that Vertigo remake with Robert Downey Jr. that was announced about a year and a half ago and hasn't seen any progress. So I'd be very curious, of course, maybe as a little small espresso episode once this is out, to talk about, can you actually remake something like Vertigo?
Yes, and why that one? That would interest me greatly. Why pick Vertigo? That is so, it's almost emblematic of Hitchcock and Jimmy Stewart. Why choose that one? There are so many that have such potential, but that is material for another podcast.
I would say, yes, the holy grail of Hitchcock remakes. Well, thanks so much, you two, for starting off our summer of remakes with a double Hitchcock. It was great fun. And there will be new episodes in the series coming up very soon. So thanks, Julie. Thanks, Matt, for joining me today.
Thank you. It was great fun once again.
Thank you.
And join us for the next episode of our summer remakes on A Damn Fine Cup of Culture. Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
Bye.